today on EdgeFX.
We tend to think of biodiversity science as related to conservation, but in fact, it's actually intimately related historically to larger projects of exploiting tropical environments throughout the 20th century.
Geographer Elliot Vaughn speaks with Megan Raby, author of the new book, American Tropics, The Caribbean Roots of Biodiversity Science. They discuss the origins of biodiversity science at field stations throughout the Caribbean, the labor practices that made those sites function, and the relationship between U.S. science and empire.
Excited to welcome Dr. Megan Raby to the podcast today. We'll be talking about her recent book called American Tropics, The Caribbean Roots of Biodiversity Science. So thank you for joining us today, Megan.
It's great to be here, Elliot. I'm really happy to take part in a podcast for EdgeFX.
I was curious if you could just kind of start by giving us a brief introduction to what your book is about and how you got interested in this project in the first place.
Yeah. So what I basically look at is the history of the idea of biodiversity and the roots that it has in field work in the tropics, in particular the Circum-Caribbean region in the 20th century. So I look at how U.S. ecologists set up field stations in places like Cuba, Puerto Rico, Panama, Jamaica, and how they use those sites to work in place over time, and in that way built up an understanding of living tropical organisms and began to ask themselves about what evolutionary and ecological causes could explain the diversity that they saw in those places. But what's also key, right, is that they're working in those sites for a particular reason, and that is because these are places where they can take advantage of U.S. corporate land holdings or U.S. government land holdings in the case of the Panama Canal Zone. And so U.S. ecologists, we tend to think of biodiversity science as related to conservation, but in fact, it's actually intimately related historically to larger projects of exploiting tropical environments throughout the 20th century.
How did you first kind of get involved in studying this, and what was your initial interest in this topic?
Well, I've been interested in the relationship between place and science for a long time. I originally did my undergraduate degree in paleontology, so I have a science background to start with, and I got into history of science through learning about environmental history and coming from Montana State to University of Wisconsin-Madison. My interest in the environment and interest in science kind of become mixed together. So I'm interested in how places shape science, and I became aware of the fact that there's been a lot of work about the relationship between lab science and field science, right, in the 19th and 20th century. And as I was looking into this, looking into U.S. field science, I saw a lot more field scientists than I expected working in the tropics. And I found out about first a field station called Soledad that Harvard ran in Cuba by reading Stuart McCook's book on agricultural science in the Caribbean. And it interested me, and I found out that it's not just agricultural science that was done there, but also basic biological science. And in fact, people like E.O. Wilson got their first experience in a tropical environment by taking a class at Harvard there at Soledad. So I was interested in what it was. Why were these Americans in these tropical places in it? And the answer is pretty clear once you start to dig into it.
So have you had a chance to visit any of these stations? And if so, how is that kind of informed how you view them or how you write about them in your book?
Yeah, the one that I have most experience, and I haven't been to all of them because I do talk about a large network of stations, but the station that is the longest standing tropical station in the Western Hemisphere and that remains a central site for tropical biological research is the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute at Barro Colorado Island in Panama. And that dates back to 1923. Although the canal zone was transferred in the 1970s and the operation of the canal has been transferred to the Panamanians in 1999, Barro Colorado Island remains part of the Smithsonian Institution. And so it's kind of intriguing to see this station that has such a long history that although there's some memory of that history there written into the landscape because, for example, the trails are named after scientists and workers who worked there in the early 20th century. The full history of the island is not really known on the island. And the problem is that you go there and, you know, English is still the main language that's spoken on Barrow, Colorado Island, whereas the rest of Panama is clearly Spanish. And so there's legacies, right, that remain there at these research stations. In that case, one that is now successfully transferred to being a fully Smithsonian Panamanian institution insofar as its administration, and yet it has this history that I think is important to remember.
One important theme that comes up several times in the book is this tension between the scientists who started these stations needing a space to do pure science, but being reliant on the resources and funding and access to these sites from entities with other motives. Can you maybe explain one example where this was particularly obvious? And if so, and do you think that this tension actually affected the science being done so that it was less pure than the original scientists hoped? Or was it more, as you mentioned, about just access to these sites and funding?
So maybe the best example is that station at Soledad near Cienfuegos in Cuba, because it was originally started shortly after the Spanish-American War as a sugar experiment station. So one with clearly quite economic motives, right? The improvement of varieties of sugar. But because the sugar baron who owned the Soledad plantation, who was one of the most powerful planters, Massachusetts-based powerful planter in Cuba, contacted these Harvard botanists and zoologists later to help him with this, they had their own motives as well. And they gradually convinced him over time to incorporate things like a botanical garden, partly as a kind of a source of prestige for him, right? He could show visitors around his botanical garden and show himself to be a sponsor of science and something that's beautiful. But also as botanical gardens also have an important scientific purpose as a sort of a living collection of plants. And then by the 20s, they convinced him to add a basic biological laboratory so that visitors, mainly Harvard students, but also others, could come and do work in a laboratory, but also press plants and things like that. And Soledad also served on the side as kind of a base of operations for collecting excursions further afield. So, for example, the Zapata Swamp or the Trinidad Mountains, places where there's remnant forests or where there's wetlands, places that we still recognize today as sources of great biological diversity. So you can see that there's a great mixture here. In just that example, there's not really one answer. And there's never anything that's quite totally pure science. The researchers who visited, some got fellowships in order to come visit that were sponsored by the sugar baron's money. And that money actually continues at Harvard, even though the Soledad station is no longer Harvard's and is now operated by Cubans, right, after the Cuban Revolution in 1959. So there's legacies that are sort of hidden of that sponsorship of science. Does it affect the science itself? I would argue that it does, and in particular in this way, and this is one of the key arguments of the book, is that it's not only that working in place helped ecologists develop particular kinds of field practices for monitoring and measuring and theorizing about diversity, but also that they began to frame what they were doing as relevant to broader interests, even when they're doing basic ecological work, right? That this in some way connects to broader economic interests because the diversity itself is a resource. What they'd argue is that it's more prudent, people like Thomas Barber, for example, in the early 20th century, who was the director of that Soledad station, but also of Barrow, Colorado Island in Panama at the same time in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, argued that if you're a corporation or the U.S. government, you should sponsor tropical biology because you don't know what possible economic resources could be out there. So we're quite familiar with the idea that there's like a cancer cure out there in a rainforest somewhere. This is kind of the origins of that kind of idea. So that instead of sponsoring just a sugarcane expert, you would sponsor people who had broad tropical experience and who could make connections that might be able to develop new resource. But also to get a population of biologists, right, out there who had experience working in these environments and might then be hired for a variety of different uses later on. And that definitely exploded after World War II.
Yeah, and I actually found that was something I found really interesting about this book was this importance of these specific places to doing the science, but then how the scientists who were working here needed to essentially globalize their work. And so this whole idea of biodiversity in some ways came out of a need to, or a desire to generalize and abstract these place-based studies to make it applicable worldwide or to other audiences or funding audiences. So I thought that that tension and dynamic was really interesting.
I'm glad, because I have to say that that part of it was an interesting part for me to discover as I worked on it. And to admit that this is a book that comes out of a dissertation, that's a part of it that I didn't have, that effort to abstract, to reduce down to indexes like species diversity, or to put species diversity into ecological models. That happens after World War II with people like Robert MacArthur and Howard T. Odom. That part is so abstracted from place in the way that those ecologists wrote about what they were doing and presented their work, that it's very hard then to connect it back up to these places. But if you look at where they work, the sites that they work have a long institutional history, and they worked in places that are still major nodes of ecological research in the tropics today.
One other kind of interesting thing that comes out of this tension between the place-based and then just generally like the abstraction of biodiversity, mm-hmm. is you see like more recent examples where sometimes the lack of biodiversity is brought up as a maybe some place being less worthy of conservation. So I think of the example mm-hmm. of when they were proposing drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and a senator holds up a blank piece of paper to show like that there's no diversity there to protect. Mm-hmm. So do you think that this focus on biodiversity is like the key metric? Has it in some ways backfired from a conservationist's mm-hmm. perspective, or, you know, the typical conservation model?
I think that's a really excellent question. And I think what I would say, because I'm a historian, is I'd back up and I'd say, number one, definitely there are values and different kinds of trade-offs in focusing on biodiversity as your rationale for conservation. But I'd say that number two, there's a reason that biodiversity as a rationale for conservation ends up attracting our attention to places like tropical rainforests, although, of course, there's a variety of environments in the tropics, right? Not all of which are the most diverse places in the world. But it's because the people who argued for biodiversity as this conservation rationale in the 1980s, after the 1985 Biodiversity Conference at the Smithsonian and the National Academies of Science, which coined the term, the people who promoted that were, for the most part, tropical biologists. And the reason they were doing that was because they felt that they needed to renew patronage and focus on their work, right? It's not just a conservation crisis that makes them make this argument in the late 70s and 80s, but it's actually their response to a totally reorganized geopolitical circumstance where, through most of the 20th century, tropical biologists had relied on U.S. patronage. And in the 60s and 70s, they have to find a new way. So that's a long-winded way of answering your question and maybe acknowledging that there's trade-offs to focusing on biodiversity, pointing out that there's a historical reason why it focuses us on particular regions, maybe to the neglect of others.
So I'm curious if you could share what you hope different audiences might take from this book. So specifically, the two that come to mind are ecologists who work in the tropics and then maybe historians of science. So these different audiences that you write to both of them.
Yeah. So, I mean, number one for ecologists who work in the tropics and maybe just ecologists who work anywhere is I'd really hope that scientists who work in the field think more about the places that they work as having a human history, and one that also involves a politics and power involved in who's able to access those sites. So ecologists working in the tropics who were American ecologists had connections to certain kinds of power that allowed them to work in those sites. And partly because biologists have long kind of focused on what they see as pristine sites or wilderness, or at least they're focused on the natural part of the systems that they're studying in this historical period and only recently becoming more interested in the human aspects. Sometimes those histories are erased. For example, on Barrow, Colorado Island, you know, it is a constructed island that it was an artificial, it was a hill, it became an island when the Panama Canal was flooded. And there were a handful of subsistence farmers and people who grew small amounts of bananas to sell living on that island who were paid to leave the island when it became a nature park and a research station. So histories like that, I think, are important for scientists to know, partly because it affects the actual landscape and biology of the places that they are studying, and therefore it's something they should inherently be interested in, but also because I think it should help them start to think about who are they working with in place now, right? And when working at a field station, there's so many benefits scientifically, right, to long-term research, to having huge data sets, to having lots of labor to help you. But sometimes it can be very insulating from people who might live nearby or maybe who once had access to that site and maybe no longer do. So it can be very hard to work against those institutional structures and try to get to know people, including scientists from the country that one's working in, who may have less, ironically, less access to that local site than someone from far away. And that can be very problematic. It's not very comfortable to talk about. And I want to make it clear, I really think the work that the people who do in these sites is really important and cool, and I love it. But it has a really problematic history. You're not going to get over it by forgetting it, right? And so by talking about all these sites, you can see a kind of pattern develop. So that's maybe what I want ecologists to think about. Historians of science, we have long been interested in science and empire, but there's a kind of hangover of American exceptionalism, perhaps, where we haven't looked as much at U.S. science and empire, especially when it comes to sciences that are not obviously economic in nature. And so when someone's studying monkey behavior on Barrow, Colorado Island, like, how does that connect to empire? Well, so I think that's worth looking at in that case. Looking at lab and field, that's a spatial way of thinking about things, but we can also get maybe deeper into the environmental and colonial histories of our scientific field stations as well.
That brings up this idea of colonial science. And in some ways, it seems like you didn't feel like that truly fully described what was happening here. Is that a fair assessment, or would you describe what these ecologists were doing as colonial science?
So yeah, there's a lot of debate about the term colonial science. Helen Tilley, for example, has argued we shouldn't necessarily use that term. There's nothing different or less scientific about science done in colonial contexts than other kinds of science. So I understand those critiques. I do think, given what I just said about how the study of U.S. science has not been as focused as, say, the study of 19th century British science on the problem of empire, I think it's rhetorically worth using the word colonial. And in fact, as my first chapter talks about, U.S. scientists at first also actually worked in British colonial territory. And so it's definitely taking place in colonial context there. So I think highlighting it, although I understand the critique and it's understandable to me, I do think it helps you see things like the labor structures at research stations that really borrow from colonial labor structures in whatever place that you're talking about. So at Soledad, people who worked at the larger sugar plantation were kind of brought in to work on the garden and at the station. At Barrow, Colorado Island, the labor on the island actually kind of mirrors the broader segregated labor force of the silver and gold roll system in the Panama Canal Zone, which is racially segregated and, in fact, even on this tiny island, the water and things like that were segregated. So if you think about it, highlighting the colonial context, and I think in that draws attention to the thing that we tend to forget if we are looking maybe simply at the intellectual history.
So your book obviously traces the history of these science stations and kind of ends looking at what's happening at these field stations now. And the very end is sort of hopeful in the sense that access to these stations has improved in many ways, and that the stations that remained, that still exist, had to negotiate this tension with their host countries and in some ways adapt to situations and calls for better access. So what challenges still remain, though? Obviously, it's not perfect still. What challenges still remain? How do you see this kind of history helping helping address those challenges.
Yeah. So as you say, right, in the 1960s, this period of time when it wasn't at all clear that that these stations would be able to remain in place, right? In Panama in the 1960s, you have protests in the public and efforts to get the canal zone treaties renegotiated, and they were indeed during all this broader kind of diplomatic work that's going on between the U.S. and Panama in the 70s. The Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute is also kind of doing their own kind of scientific diplomacy to try to renegotiate their place, to distance themselves, right, from the U.S. government, and to show themselves as a scientific institution that can serve Panama as well as global science and global conservation. Actually, for the first time, too, they start to talk about that. And they're very successful at doing that. They're still here, and they are now also a Panamanian institution. The other organization that successfully kind of passes through this period of time, but actually is the newest of the ones that I talk about, is the Stations of the Organization for Tropical Studies in Costa Rica. And though that, you know, that institution is quite different from the other ones that I talked about in the book, in that it, from the start, was a Costa Rican U.S. organization. Of course, there were several U.S. universities and the University of Costa Rica, but at least at its core, it was meant to be a truly international organization from the start. Those organizations, you know, the more recent history, they, I think, really are dedicated to, I'm not here to tell people what to do in the present, but I do think that for U.S. biologists who are working in these places, it's especially worth knowing this history so that perhaps you can think about acting in a way that connects you to local scientific communities and listens to them, and local communities who aren't scientists, and listens to them, because that historically is not what what happened. There's still a lot of challenges. It depends on what countries you're talking about.
It's hard to tell people what to do now, but as long as acknowledging what happened in the past is part of the solution.
One thing that I notice, right, is that often the people who are in charge of field stations, field station directors and promoters, and also the scientists who have long-term kind of projects at these stations, are often understandably so focused on supporting and maintaining those stations and those projects, and they feel themselves, especially in comparison to things like molecular biology or physics, right, to be operating on a shoestring budget. Ecological science, this, with some exceptions, has not been big science, and it's not overloaded in cash. But when you look at it from the other side, U.S. scientists who don't see themselves as very rich, right, have actually, in comparison to the scientific communities who are operating as neighbors, right, really are, right? And so that's a difficult situation to deal with, but just maybe knowing about it could also be a first step.
You started mentioning some of your visits to some of these field stations. I was curious if you kind of expand a little bit on, you know, how visiting these.
And when I first visited the Smithsonian Institution Archives, which are in Washington, D.C. So I spent a lot more time in Washington, D.C. and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, than unfortunately on the beach in the Caribbean, right? Well, when I went to the Smithsonian Institution Archives for the first time, what I was expecting as an early grad student beginning this project was, you know, there's records from Barrow, Colorado Island, so it's a great historical record. There's many, 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 many boxes of documents. I expected to learn a lot about scientific practice on the site. And what most of those letters and documents are about is managing labor, right? It's mostly about hiring people to clear trails and cook and how to keep people working on the station. And so encountering that in those sources totally changed the way I was thinking about it. I was really thinking about how, and I still talk about, there's plenty of intellectual history and history of scientific practice in this book, but I would just say that I was looking for that, but what I saw ultimately in the documents, stations are sites of labor, right? And by scientists and by many other people who support all that. So that was eye-opening in my in my naive way as a grad student who was beginning this project very long ago at this point. And that's what I began to then see in other sites and look for more consciously in other sites. Probably I should have been looking for that in the first place, but definitely the endless letters talking about how to keep a good cook on the island, right? So Nemesia Rodriguez, I'll name her, one of the early Barrow Colorado Island cooks, right? She really was good at manipulating James Netek, who was the station director, right? By because it's tough to work on an island that's forested, that's a boat trip away from nearest city, town. So she would leave for a while and say she was going to quit, and he'd have to give her some better conditions and things like that. And so there's the stories of all these people, most of whom are largely forgotten, although her name is on an island trail, a trail on Barrow, Colorado Island. So people like that, just learning about these people and seeing photographs of them was just one of the coolest parts of doing the research for this project.
Thank you very much for taking time out to talk to us, Megan. It was very interesting. And yeah, thank you for stopping by.
Thanks so much, Elliot. It's really great to meet you and talk about this.
That was geographer Elliot Vaughn speaking with Megan Raby, assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. They discussed her new book, American Tropics, The Caribbean Roots of Biodiversity Science. Megan has also published articles in American Scientist and ISIS, a journal of the History of Science Society. She's at work on a new book project on the life of Marston Bates and the changing role of science and environment in U.S. relations with the Global South. You've been listening to Edge Effects, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode was produced by Addie Hopes, Sarah Thomas, Brian Hamilton, and me, Charles Carlin. The music you're hearing is by Julian Lynch. We'll be back soon with episodes featuring author Heather Swan from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Tim Beam from Humboldt State University. You can get all of our episodes sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to the EdgeFX podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review. That really helps us connect to new listeners. Follow us on Twitter at EdgeFXMag. And, as always, keep up with the steady flow of great content about cultural and environmental change across the full sweep of human history at edgefx.net.